I'm Brenda Power, and this is The Media Show. In this edition, rolling it there with Ryan Tuberty and the Late Late Show team.
It's like you're in your rugby kit in the tunnel, and you can hear the roar of the crowd, and you're about to emerge.
And half a century on, how good is Irish telly?
You have to provide some things for some people some of the time. You can't keep everyone happy.
Also, Serview PJ. What's that all about?
PJ, the digital switchover is coming. We're ready, aren't we?
But first, the huge media focus on the McAreevy murder trial highlights the taut relationship between the press and the law. Justice has to be done in public, but one false move by a court reporter and an entire trial could collapse. This week, the McAreevy family asked the international media to be cautious in its coverage of the tragic case for fear that an unguarded comment, like a tweet, for example, or a report of evidence given in the absence of the jury, might derail the whole process.
We hope that the media will understand that we are anxious that nothing will be said or done that will compromise or prejudice due process during the trial.
Simon McAleese is a leading media lawyer. Simon, just explain the risks here.
It's becoming increasingly harder for judges in jury trials to ensure that jurors steer clear of what is in the media, because the media is now all around them. I mean, there was a point where you only had to worry about what was on the television or on the radio. But of course, now we have the internet to contend with. And indeed, it's simply the internet is so pervasive that while jurors might heed the judge's injunction to steer clear of the media, they will probably learn, even with the best will in the world, from members of their family or people close to them, of material that mightn't necessarily be before the court during the course of the trial. And that's the big concern that trial judges now have to contend with.
What can happen? Say, for instance, somebody took a chance and reported something, some juicy detail that came out in the absence of the jury in Mauritius, and it made it into the papers here. What happens then, or what could potentially happen?
The big issue is whether or not the jury is found to have learned of something material to the trial which didn't make its way to them through the evidence given in court. And if that is the case, irrespective of whether or not it actually corrupted their thought processes, there will be a finding that the trial has been unduly influenced by what has been learned. I mean, it has happened in a number of trials where the presiding judge has discovered that jurors have, contrary to the judge's rulings, accessed the internet and obtained information about the case and about the circumstances surrounding the case and all to do with the case via the internet. And in fact, juries have been discharged on that basis.
Now, I know there have been cases in the States where juries have been discharged when a juror befriended an accused on Facebook. They have a much more lax rules, though, as evidenced by the Strauss-Kahn case.
Yes, they do. And I sometimes wonder, I mean, you see and hear news footage from the United States where you have what's known as the perp walk, where the accused is marched towards the court in shackles and the media are virtually lined up to take pictures of the accused. This would be in circumstances where the accused hasn't been granted bail. But even where the accused has been granted bail, you'll invariably be shown the accused doing the perp walk on the way to the bail hearing. And that footage is invariably shown after the accused has been granted bail. So that's the type of footage and coverage that in Ireland the media are prohibited from showing. There's quite a strong series of cases going up to the Supreme Court warning the media that you cannot show the accused in shackles or handcuffs either before or during the course of his or her trial. It's deemed to be prejudicial. It's automatically deemed to poison the minds of the jurors.
In Norway, which has no jury, it's a non-jury trial, the Breivik trial, members of the media have been tweeting from the courtroom. Do you think that's a risk?
When you don't have a jury, you really needn't worry, because the trial is being heard by a judge sitting alone. That's what happens in a lot of criminal law cases in Ireland, which are heard in front of the district court, for example, or in front of the special criminal court. You don't have a jury. You needn't really worry about what the media publish or about what is put about on Twitter or any of the new media. It's when you have a jury, you have to be worried if you're a lawyer, if you're for the prosecution or the defence, and indeed the trial judge primarily, you have to be worried about what's known as the sub judice rule, which ensures, that's a rule designed to ensure that the jury decide on the evidence in front of them and their knowledge of the case is such that it's only based upon the evidence that has been given to the court and given to them, not on what has been learned elsewhere. It's a much abused expression, the subjudice expression. You hear politicians and various other people in trouble saying, I can't comment, this is the subject of a legal challenge, or this is my solicitor has written a letter to contest this charge, it's subjudice. That's nonsense. The subjudice rule is a very narrow rule. It's designed to ensure that juries in criminal trials are not adversely or unduly influenced by what they see, hear or learn from a source other than the prosecution or the defence.
There is, I suppose, necessarily a tension between the media and the legal process, particularly when it comes to the hearing of a criminal trial that is attracting a lot of attention, because obviously the media want as much information as they possibly can. There is an obligation that the law be seen to be done. What then is the reservations about televising criminal proceedings?
This is a thorny old question, and it keeps arising. Should we have television cameras in court? In Ireland, we have the most limited of access. You sometimes see pictures of the judges in criminal trials and other trials on the RTE News or in any other newscast. You see them sitting down at the bench, or indeed in their office or chambers, as it's known, and fiddling with a pen or whatever the posed position is for the camera. And that's, of course, highly artificial, and it doesn't reflect what goes on during the trial. And criminal trials are very tense processes. You have hanging in the balance the liberty of the subject. You have the prosecution doing their damnedest to secure a conviction, the defence doing their damnedest to secure an acquittal. And you have on the fringe a debate which is ongoing about whether or not there should be television cameras in court. If you look at some of the cases in the United States, particularly that have been covered by television, O.J. Simpson and Michael Jackson's doctor and so forth, I have to say I'm not very pleased or satisfied with what I see, because they do, with the best will in the world, tend to turn into a bit of a media event rather than a trial event. And I think the television coverage tends to generate a certain dynamic, which I don't think is good for the court process or the trial process, and indeed becomes somewhat sensationalised to a point which is uncontrollable.
You can't bring cameras into Irish courts, yet you can send an artist in to do a representation. That might strike people as a little bit silly.
I'd agree with that. I think I don't think there's anything wrong with stills, photographs, but if you have a witness giving evidence and flash bulbs going off in the back of the court and the whole scenario descending to what sometimes you see happening at modern weddings, where the priest is virtually told to hold it while I take a picture of you holding up the chalice or whatever, you cannot have anything that interferes. Maybe some sort of covert footage that can be accessed after the trial and published after the trial is the answer to this debate. I mean, what you have in the courts at the moment, and it was introduced on a trial basis, and I think at the moment it's been expanded throughout the four courts, is digital recording of court hearings. So I think in virtually most of the courts now, if not all of them, you have digital recording of the proceedings in court. In the event that there is any subsequent controversy about what happened on a certain date and time in court, the recording can be replayed. People don't even know they're being recorded most of the time, even though there are signs up saying that the hearing is being recorded. You could very well do that with modern technology. You know, you could have film footage and CCTV. I mean, the sound recording is there already.
And with regard to the coverage of a case like the McAreevy case, which is obviously going to attract huge attention, insofar as the papers and the media will want to comment on what they see in court, what are the restrictions on comment in a case like that?
If it's an Irish case and it comes in front of an Irish jury in the Central Criminal Court, they cannot deal with the case on anything other than the evidence that has been presented to them. Be it visual or oral evidence, they must learn what they know about the case from the evidence and nothing else. They will be directed by the trial judge and they will hear submissions from the prosecution and the defence. It's as simple as that. If the media step outside that and decide, for whatever reason, by way of mistake or otherwise, that they're going to give the jury information, critical information, evidential information that hasn't been heard before the court, oops, they've trespassed against the sub judice rule. That's when you have a scenario which is known as contempt of court comes into play. They'll be deemed to be in contempt of court and they'll be hauled in front of the judge to explain themselves. Very often, you know, with the best will in the world, contempts of court arise from pure mistake. Yeah. It's a very complicated thing to cover a complex criminal trial. And those of you in the media who do so play an extraordinary role. I mean, I see it time and again, and I'm gobsmacked with the speed and the accuracy with which complex information is digested and relayed to the public via the media. I don't think there's half enough appreciation of what the reporting media do for the public in that regard.
And that was Simon McAleese. Now, it began as a light filler programme in the summer of 1962, at a time when 9.30 probably was late, and has gone on to be the world's longest-running chat show. Half a century on, it is as old as Irish television itself. Our reporter, Paula Kniff, has been behind the scenes at the Late Late Show. Hi, Paula, how'd you get on?
It was actually very exciting. I'd never been to the Late Late Show before or inside the studios at RTE. The Late Late Show is filmed in Studio 4, which is the biggest studio, seats 200 people. It's very high end, a lot different, I noticed, to TV3 where I was a couple of weeks ago. So there were, you know, tons of lights and lots of camera people, lots of production going into the show. So the first person I bumped into was the lovely host, Ryan Tuberty.
Very few people will ever understand what it's like to present a live programme like The Late Late Show for 2 hours solid. It's a small club. The other members happen to be Pat Kenny and Gay Byrne. And it's very hard to try and explain it because it is so enormous and difficult and enjoyable.
Okay, kill that one, sorry. One.
You're about 20 minutes before the moment I get really nervous, where I can only imagine it's like you're in your rugby kit in the tunnel. And you can hear the roar of the crowd and you're about to emerge. So that's a very exciting 20 minutes, but it's nerve-wracking too. And it happens every Friday, and I think it's fuel.
OK, so Paula, so what went on behind the scenes before the audience and the guests took their places?
Well, it is very highly produced. There's a big sense of control in the production process. So they have multiple rehearsals where Ryan rehearses his script. They bring in some of the guests and he'll talk to them. And then all the bands rehearse as well. I was surprised by how many staff were in the studio by 7 p.m. between cameras, lights, floor staff, and then everything is practiced beforehand. So all the camera angles, all the lighting, everything has already been decided upon before the show airs at 9.30. And this is Michael Keeley, the executive producer of The Late Late Show.
We have quite a large production team. We have 13, including Ryan. That's broken down in terms of two producers. We then have five researchers. We have a music associate. It's probably the biggest production of the week.
The role of researcher involves sourcing, securing guests. My name is Catherine Cal, and I'm a researcher on The Late Late Show. A big part of the process would be talking to the guest and establishing their story, and very much establishing, because it's television, how they tell it, and if they can tell it, and if they can tell it within a certain time frame.
Celebrities aren't as willing these days to jump and appear just because we want them to come on The Late Late Show, and we have to work around their schedule as opposed to them in the past usually appearing whenever we wanted them to. Generally speaking, we like to maintain the exclusivity of certain guests. It helps the cachet of The Late Late Show in terms of appearing on it. It helps certainly from audience terms if somebody hasn't told their story on radio and television throughout the week and that we're the last person that they tell the story to. Exclusivity does matter. We're fortunate in that most people want to tell their story on The Late Late Show first.
Hello, how are you? Have a great night.
There's a huge amount of the show that's not filmed. That is great fun. Before the show starts, I'll go out for a few minutes and I'll say happy birthday to people and happy anniversary, and we'll have a bit of crack around the scenes. And equally then, during the ad breaks, the band, who are critical to the programme's existence because they keep the party going. If people are happy in studio, it will add to the sense of occasion, the excitement, and then that equally then spills into television at home because they think, oh, I'd love to be there.
Good evening. Good evening. I won't get any prizes. Good evening.
So once that rehearsal is over, Ryan has one more run through of his script and then the guests start arriving. And there is a real party atmosphere in the studio, Brenda. It was actually very fun. The house band play and they warm up the crowd. They give out some prizes and then Ryan will come out and have a chat with everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome, it's Ryan Tuberty!
And that was Paula Kniff at The Late Late Show. Well, RTE's 50th anniversary is obviously a nostalgic time, but maybe some of our favourite souvenirs are looking a little tatty with age. So is Irish television due a major declutter? Helen O'Rahilly, a self-proclaimed TV maven, is a former executive in both RTE and the BBC and is now an independent television consultant. Helen, you've been highly critical of RTE's output lately. You described a recent Late Late Show item as pure shite. So tell us what you really think. What's wrong with Irish television?
How long have we got? I mean, the Late Late Show, I would completely revitalise. I would certainly get rid of the Saturday Night Show, and I would revitalise some factual that's looking very, very tatty across the week, because factual is where you make savings a lot in television, and God knows RTE has to make savings. You know, you can't afford to be snobbish in television, particularly with big channels like RTE One or BBC One. You have to provide some things for some people some of the time. You can't keep everyone happy. If you have budget cuts to the extent of 50 million across television stations like RTE 1 and 2, I mean, that is potentially catastrophic. And it cuts into the very heart of your programming. It has to. You will have fewer reporters. You will have fewer outside broadcasts, which cost money. Anything that costs a lot of money will be cut back. You have to come up with creative solutions to those sort of difficulties. And RTE needs to think about how, if they've got a good brand, how do you make that reach deeper into your community and get people listening during the day and build up a sense of excitement about projects, and very Irish projects as well. If I was director of television now, I would be thinking about that. What's 2013's big event on RTE that everybody will make that appointment to view and sit down and either watch it when it's transmitted or watch it recorded or on the iPlayer?
And that was Helen O'Rahilly. Now, thanks to these very annoying adverts, you cannot have missed the fact that there are big changes coming to a television near you.
PJ, the digital switchover is coming. We're ready, aren't we? It's all in hand, Tommy.
It's not just Ireland. By 2012, every television signal across Europe will be broadcast digitally.
We'll still get to watch the match, right, PJ? Like you've never seen it before, Tommy.
So one of the major developments of RTE's 50th year will be the switch from analogue to digital television on October the 24th next. That will mean that if you're still hooked up to an aerial on October the 25th, you'll be looking at a blank screen. When the Minister for Communications, Pat Rabbit, was in with us last week, we asked him about the digital switchover.
I think it's going very well. We have an outreach programme where we have spent some money to involve the local community organisations, whether it is the GAA or the Wheel or Rural Link, whatever it is. And we have a digital champion in each county. And, of course, especially in the western counties, that's important, or the areas of concentration on the old analogue signal. And they work in the local parish to raise awareness, to help older people, to help people who are more isolated, to explain to them what's involved in the switchover and getting a set-top box and how do you set it up and all that kind of thing. It's doing very good work, and people have taken to it with some gusto. We also had a report on the technical people and the rollout of the infrastructure and so on, and that's going immensely well, which is not to say that there aren't some difficulties, whether it is in the hills of Kerry or Donegal or Mayo, where the topography is difficult and so on, and where it was always difficult. Famous last words, which no doubt you will bring me back to account for. I would be confident that a very good job is being done and that we will be ready for the big day.
Is it very expensive?
Well, RTE has put some 70 million into building out the change capacity. If there wasn't an RTE, who would put in that 70 million? I don't think people understand that this switch off is happening across Europe. There's no point, whether you're in my native county or in any other county, saying, well, this will never catch on down here. I mean, it is going to happen. It's also very important, from my point of view, for an additional reason, which is that it will free up valuable spectrum, and that spectrum will be auctioned. And that in itself holds out the prospect of enhancing broadband capacity in parts of the country that badly need it.
Minister Pat Rabbit being very upbeat about the digital switch over there. Now, Ken Murphy of DIT Media Studies. Ken, you're not convinced that it's all going quite so smoothly. Still a lot of confusion around all of this, of course. How many people, first of all, are affected by this?
Well, a sound sheet is 1.6 million television households in the Irish Republic. Out of that, 16% are still receiving their television signals free-to-air. Essentially, we have 250,000 households which receive their television signal free-to-air, and they're the main target group for Serview. They're the main group that need to think about upgrading to a set-top box or an integrated digital television set. The Department of Communications and Natural Resources have been carrying out studies to see how aware essentially the public are in relation to the digital transition, and the suggestion is that, you know, 3/4 of the population have an understanding of the digital switchover and their need to either upgrade their analog television sets or continue on with the services that they have via cable or satellite, as is. There is still a proportion of the population that does not seem to be getting the message in relation to the digital transition. You know, there's still work to be done there.
Are these boxes readily available, and how much do they cost?
The boxes are readily available. The average cost ranges from €100 to €150. We have seen boxes being produced that are not approved for Serview but are available for €50. So I think consumers need to be very aware in relation to the chances they're taking by buying a set-top box that may not be approved. All of the equipment that is approved to receive digital terrestrial signals should essentially carry a Serview-ready sticker.
So don't buy it off the back of a lorry.
Don't buy it off the back of the lorry. Look for that sticker, because that's your guarantee that you will actually get pictures and that it will be, you know, capable of being upgraded in the future as digital terrestrial television changes.
And just to be clear, for those 250,000 households, there is no need to wait until the 24th of October. You can get it now and install it now?
You can get it now and install it now. Serview has a website which gives a listing of all the approved retailers and also gives an indication of the models for sale, the various different set-top box and integrated digital television sets that are for sale.
And any idea, Ken, at this stage, what the uptake is on the boxes?
We don't have any official figures. I have heard unofficial figures that suggest that only 50,000 boxes have been sold. That excludes the amount of integrated digital television sets that have been sold. We have no figure for that whatsoever. I suppose the suggestion at this point is that uptake is sluggish.
And that was Ken Murphy from DIT there. Now, this week's Media Watch essay is from Eleanor Fitzsimons.
Women are significantly underrepresented in the broadcast media. In 2010, the Global Media Monitoring Project, which includes Ireland, reported that less than one in four people interviewed, seen, heard or written about in mainstream print and broadcast news is a woman. Typically, they are allocated softer topics, less time and fewer column inches. The women who make it onto our airwaves are rarely invited as experts. Fewer than 20% of contributors introduced as experts are women. Fewer than 15% of weekday Irish radio presenters are women. The current affairs television programmes that purport to deal with the issues affecting us all rarely reflect this in the composition of their panels. At best, they tick the token woman box. At worst, they just leave it blank. RTÉ's The Week in Politics, which draws its contributors from a dole that is 85% male, has prompted a Twitter-based viewer challenge known as Spot the Rogue Woman. The Media Monitoring Report found media managers quick to offer excuses. They say that they couldn't persuade any woman to speak, or that there wasn't time to find a suitable expert who was a woman. This reflects the deeper inequalities in a society where few leaders are women. The report concludes that the media's tendency to talk about rather than to or through women is deeply embedded in culture. Margaret Gallagher, media expert, believes that access to media is rarely blocked through overt discrimination. Invisible barriers such as stereotyped attitudes, biases, presumptions and outdated organisational structures operate to accommodate men and disadvantage women. The European Parliament believes that the underrepresentation and stereotyped portrayal of women confines them to a passive and secondary role. Consciously or not, the media perpetuates gender inequality. The conclusion was that improved visibility and representation of women is a democratic right.
And that was Eleanor Fitzsimons. Twitter probably has a higher proportion of journalists among its users than any other form of social media. It's a neat platform for opinions, for breaking news and for gossip, all grist to the media mill. The Sunday Times deputy editor John Burns tweets frequently on a Saturday night to flag the next day's headlines. Now, John, it has been called ego media. Why do hacks love Twitter so much?
The great aspect of Twitter from a journalist's point of view, and this is how I use it, is that you have hundreds of pairs of eyes and ears out there reading everything for you, hearing everything, learning everything they've read and seen. So they're almost helping you do your job. That's the way I would see it. Because they're saying things like, hey, have you seen this really interesting article in such and such a magazine on a topic that you might be interested in? And you think, great, I would not have known that was there. And here's a link to it. You know, brilliant. Or they will simply summarise huge forms of content and tell you, here is the best of what's in that, which again will save you reading it. And that's the way I see it. I'd see these people as my helpers in doing my job and as time savers as well. Where Twitter, of course, is very dangerous is in raising rumours that, you know, often don't turn out to be quite accurate. I mean, sometimes there's a general kernel of truth to them, but you need to be careful because, of course, there are several prominent Irish people who have been said to be dead when they weren't, you know. That's fine if it's Wednesday afternoon. A Sunday journalist is not going to be shaken by that. But when a story breaks like that on Saturday at 6 o'clock and you're right on deadline and you're drawing up the front page, that can be very dangerous. You have to take all these tweets reasonably seriously, particularly if they come from people that you know are genuinely or are generally trustworthy. But you just have to use it as a general alert system, really, and do obviously all the checks that you normally would. But I think one or two people have fallen into the trap of taking those kind of tweets a little bit too seriously. So I don't think any newspaper has fallen for that very badly, but I think at this stage we're all very, very conscious that you've got to be careful with tweets, particularly ones close to deadline.
And that was John Burns of the Sunday Times there. And if you want to find us on Twitter, use hashtag RTE Media Show. I'm Brenda Power, and you've been listening to The Media Show. Coming up next week, the TED Talks phenomenon, ideas that are changing the world and reaching over 750 million viewers. And how apps can provide a whole new source of income for cash-strapped RTE.
I think that what we're doing is we're bringing the great RTE content to new audiences.
And are you ever too old to tweet?
I get great entertainment out of it, and it's an absolute Pandora's box.
And don't forget, you find a podcast of this programme on rte.ie/radio1/themediashow, as well as full versions of our interviews.